Okay. So last time, we had gotten this far in the proof of the Corona Theorem. Our assumption is that the vector of functions, F1, through F, I can't remember which letter I used, J, don't have any common zeros in a quantitative way. What we want is a, of course the F are also holomorphic. It's an H infinity vector. We want a vector of H infinity functions such that, in fact, the dot product is 1. Because by our maximal ideal theory, if we can establish that there exists such a G, then there's no corona. we defined to be an obvious candidate for this, the obvious candidate being F bar over the length of the vector squared, so that when you dot it with F, you get 1. Problem, of course, is that phi bar is not holomorphic. And then the next trick could be split into two pieces. We then define G to have the following form. It will be of the form F plus a matrix times, well, let me get it right. I'll forget all the details once I look it up. Phi plus A times F. So phi plus A times F where if A is anti-symmetric, then F dot G is identically 1. So at least we have some candidates for functions to mess around with to retain the 1. We don't have to use just phi, we can use phi plus anti-symmetric matrices times the vector F. And then the final observation was that if in addition, A, of course, is a function of Z. I mean, I've been suppressing the Z's here. If in addition, ddz bar of A happens to be equal to following simple matrix, which is what? Phi times d phi dz bar prime, that just means transpose, minus d phi dz bar phi transpose. So the idea here is that this phi is a column vector, and that's a row vector, so the multiplication gives you a J by J matrix. It's just a simple rank 1 J by J matrix. However, if that happens, then the calculation we did last time shows us that dg dz bar is 0. And of course, this data is anti-symmetric, and so therefore you just have to choose your constants of integration anti-symmetric and you're okay. This solves the problem. So, it turns out that in just one dimension, we don't have to exploit this difference. If you do this in higher dimensions, it becomes necessary to exploit the difference, at least all the versions I've seen exploit that. But in the disk, you can just simply solve each piece separately and add them up. So, it suffices to solve the following equation. dz bar is equal to g of z, where what is g of z? Let's just take it to be one of the entries in the matrix here, just one of them. So let's try phi iz, phi j dz bar. Let me make sure that agrees with my notes so far. Right, phi I and then phi j. And this is for any fixed ij. So you just do this for all possible choices of ij, and similarly over here, the same things, and then just put them together. The solutions, of course, will be the coefficients of the matrix A. I mean, you just do term by term in the matrix, just scalar equations, piece by piece. Let's also compute what this thing is. So we compute that dcj dz bar equals what? Well, it's d dz bar I'll write it out. D dz bar of, and then it's going to be phi j bar over the sum, fk bar, fj bar over the sum of the fk squareds. Yeah. So the idea is, if you solve this equation and you do the same thing with I and J reversed, then you look at the difference and then you have a solution to the ijth component of this matrix equals the ijth component of that matrix. Yeah, and like I say, the thing gets more complicated in higher dimensions. This part is more complicated, and the proofs I've seen anyways, we're not going to, well, we may do them later. I'm not planning to yet, but they're quite, we might. They're more complicated. They depend upon the cancellation, at least as far as I can see. Here, you don't need to worry about that. The problem is that in higher dimensions, there's more complications, and in order to solve an equation like this, you have to have a form that's closed, and so there's extra conditions on it, and you need the form that's written there. Or here, these are just functions, and so we don't need anything. Okay, what is this thing? Well, it's by the quotient rule, two things. Fj primed z bar over the bottom minus fj bar times, and then what, the sum fk primed z bar divided by this same sum but squared this time. Okay, so that's the quotient rule. Notice that when you take ddz bar and you hit one of these guys, this is of course an fkz times a fkz bar, with a bar on the fkz. When the ddz bar hits the fkz, of course it vanishes. Maybe I should just make a note of that. That's, but I actually wanted to write this out. I don't need to write it out one more time. this is since ddz bar of an fkz is 0, so that when you get the product rule applied to this term, you only get one term. You don't get the other one. And, okay. So then, right away from this, we get the following. G of z has a bound. Well, there's going to be a constant depending on the delta, because it appears in the denominator here and in the denominator there. There's also going to be the L infinity norm of the vector appearing there and here. And then the main term is you get one linear factor of f prime. So in other words, the worst derivative is just one derivative, but it just appears linearly. So you put here f prime. Okay. Maybe I'll just make a comment here anyways, even though because of the order we're doing things, it doesn't completely fit, but let me make it anyways. Because it helps explain what we do, and it helps explain Wolf's clever idea. So the comment is this: if the measure g of z dz, and by dz here I just mean dx dy when I view it as a measure in the disk. Of course, on a curve it's something different, but it just means dx dy there. So if d mu is this measure, that's just the modulus of g, if d mu is a Carlson measure, and just to remind you what that is, definition of a Carlson measure is that, I guess I should say an H2 Carlson measure, because eventually we'll talk about other Carlson measures. So what this means is that means that H2 embeds in the space L2 of mu. So it just means that when you integrate an H2 function squared times this measure, it's dominated by the H2 norm. So it's just an embedding theorem about, you know, when does this space of holomorphic functions embed into a normal familiar L2 space on the disk. And of course, if you remember, we had Carlson's theorem. We only proved it for special measures, but I pointed out that the same proofs extended to characterize Carlson measures d mu in general, not just for sums of point masses with the sub-boundary. Remember, it was a non-tangential maximal function in one direction and simple testing against reproducing kernels in the other. So this condition is if and only if mu of a tenth is equal to or less than a constant, the Lebesgue measure of the tenth. And I guess I should point out, if you want to keep track of the norms, and we should, the best constant here is, of course, what I'm going to call the Carlson measure. And if I want to emphasize it's H2, I'll put H2 Carlson measure norm of mu. It's the embedding norm. It's the norm of the embedding. This constant is comparable in this characterization. It's not equal, but it's comparable to the Carlson measure norm squared. So I just wanted to point out that here it's squared. It's just the way that that's just the way the characterization works out. Okay. If this is a Carlson measure, then the construction Peter Jones solves db dz bar equals g z with L infinity norm of B on the circle dominated by the Carlson measure norm. I should emphasize, we haven't yet done this. Or maybe I should put, we skipped this for the moment. Remember, we did the Peter Jones construction for the solution to the interpolation problem, and then we started to investigate how that solution to the interpolation problem would solve this equation. However, I then realized that when we were trying to do that, I mean, several people asked me, why? Why are we looking at this equation? And I realized it's probably not the best thing to spend a lot of effort showing how interpolation solves this equation until we actually have a reason for solving it. And of course, the reason was the Corona theorem, and you didn't know that until we went through the details. So we haven't done this part yet, but I'm just pointing out that had we continued with this, we would be done if the modulus of G is a Carlson measure. However, actually, just this reminds me of something, since we're talking about Peter Jones's solution to the interpolation problem. As soon as I get finished with this comment, I wanted to go back and make a remark that Nir pointed out to me about the Peter Jones construction. I'll just leave that for a couple of minutes till we finish this, then I'll come back to that. However, G of Z dz, or g of z, let's say, is equal to or less than somewhere we have is some constant times f prime. So it's the length of the f prime vector. But even for a scalar, f prime of z dz is not always a Carlson measure for f in H infinity. That's the problem. It's close to being a Carlson measure, but not always. I mean, typically f prime will be a Carlson measure, but not always. And it's this comment that leads to great difficulties in the proof, although Tom Wolfe's solution is really, really short and simple. But still, this is the big stumbling block. F prime is not always a Carlson measure. Maybe I'll just make one comment in that connection. For example, well, first of all, if you want to read more about this, look in Garnett's book. There isn't an easy example. At least I can't come up with one, and I cannot find one written down anywhere. And when Garnett discusses it, he gives three approaches. All three approaches are difficult and not done. They're just sort of like sketched. And some of the more difficult approaches, we don't have enough theory to go over them, so I'm not going to do the details. But this is hard to see that there's an F. But Rudin in 1955 did the following. I didn't look it up. For example, Rudin in 1955 constructed a Blaschke product, B of Z, that's certainly bounded holomorphic, with B prime Z. Not only is it not a Carlson measure, it's not even a finite measure. Oh, incidentally, Carlson measures obviously have to be finite measures, I mean, from the condition. So Rudin constructed that. I didn't actually look at the example. I fiddled with it myself for a little bit to see if I could come up. Nothing. It didn't work. Maybe one of you can come up with one easier. But anyways, the moral of the story is that we simply cannot use Peter Jones's constructive solution to the D-bar equation to solve this problem like this. So now let's do a little note. So this is not to do with this is to do with what Nir pointed out to me in an email. Recall Peter Jones's construction of, what did he have? Fj holomorphic in the disk such that one big thing happens. That is the sum j equals 1 to infinity. The modulus was equal to or less than a constant for all z's in the disk. So that's what we were left with. This is a couple of weeks ago. We constructed holomorphic functions fj such that the sum of their moduli was uniformly bounded in the disk. That was quite a strong property. And at this point, I told you that this follows from this. I said that the series without the absolute values, and this one too, converges uniformly on compact subsets. That's true, but as Nir pointed out to me, I thought it was easy. It apparently requires the equicontinuity and the Arzelà-Ascoli theorem. So let me just sketch the proof. It's not hard, but it's just something I didn't pick up when I went over it the first time. So recall, it's construction such that this, and then it follows that the series converges uniformly on compact subsets. So it follows that the series to infinity, j equals 1, fjz, converges uniformly on compact subsets of D. And of course, once you have uniform convergence of holomorphic functions, of course you know the limit is holomorphic by Morera's theorem or all sorts of things. But what's kind of peculiar here is that in order to prove, at least as far as I can see, in order to prove that this thing actually converges uniformly, you get along the way that it's holomorphic. But still, we want the series to converge uniformly, not just that it's a holomorphic function. I don't want to have to make, it follows that Aj converges uniformly on compact subsets of D for every bounded sequence Aj. Because, remember, these things interpolated ones and zeros on the set, so therefore this obviously solves the interpolation problem. We now simply want to know that it's a bounded analytic function. Obviously bounded, but why is it analytic? Also, I don't want to make sense of this in some weird way. I want to know that it converges uniformly, so that the partial sums converge. And the proof is, if you define, say, capital F sub n to be the partial sum aj fjz, then this sequence of functions fn is uniformly bounded in the disk. That's by our main assumption. You just take absolute values, use the triangle inequality, you see they're uniformly bounded in the disk. Hence, using Cauchy's theorem, I won't go through the hence, I'll just, hence, what, Cauchy's theorem, this is the standard proof, Cauchy's formula, not theorem, by Cauchy's formula, they're equicontinuous on compact subsets of the disk. And this is uniformly bounded, and hence by Cauchy's formula, equicontinuous. On compact subsets. Let's just say K of the disk. Okay, so now you can use the Arzelà-Ascoli theorem. And I'd be interested if somebody can show me a simple argument that avoids this. So by Arzelà-Ascoli, there exists a subsequence fn k, maybe, k going 1 to infinity, such that Fn k, oh, incidentally, before we go any further, this series certainly converges for each of z, converges to a function. So we can define a function. We don't know anything about it, really, other than that it's bounded. But you certainly do get a function point-wise. It makes sense. And also here, Fn converges by Arzelà-Ascoli to some continuous function in C of K, converges on K. And of course, that function has no choice but to be this one, because at every fixed point Z in K, you simply look. I mean, some subsequence of partial sums has the same limit. So you get a fixed limiting function. That's really the key to it. So by Arzelà-Ascoli, there exists a subsequence such that this goes to F on K. Moreover, this argument that we just came up with could have applied not just to the original sequence Fn, but to any subsequence. So you know where I'm going here. It's that familiar fact that in a metric space, like Ck, if you know that every subsequence has a subsequence itself converging to this limit, then in fact the full sequence converges to that limit. It's just trivial draw picture proof. But so moreover, every subsequence of Fn has a subsequence of it converging to, and it's got to be this F all the time, can't be anything else, converging to F in that metric space. I'll just emphasize that it's a metric space. In the metric space CK. And then it's well known that the original sequence has to go to the same F. And I guess after in the first instance, even up here, we had some valuable information gained that I'm not merely exploiting, but the valuable information gained at this first step, where there's a subsequence that converges to something continuous on K. However, that something, if you test it at point Z by this special thing, must be that. So we already knew F was continuous, even before. And once you know that, there's other ways to prove it. But you still need Arzelà-Ascoli to show that F is continuous. Once you have continuity of the function, then you can use all sorts of easy things. But anyway, we'll just continue with this proof. So converging, moreover, every subsequence converging to that in the metric space, thus Fn converges to F in Ck. Yeah, so the point here was that F is actually in Ck. That was something we didn't know until then. And, okay, I won't give a proof, but you look at the original sequence F, Fn, and if there is, if it doesn't converge to the pink thing, that means that there must exist some epsilon neighborhood in the metric space such that infinitely many blue things are outside of it. You can find a subsequence that stays outside, but the subsequence also converges to the thing inside. It's impossible. Okay, so that ends the remark, and I thank Nir for pointing that out. I was under the false impression that uniform convergence was just trivial. Yeah, can't see a trivial proof. And I think I was thrown off is not the right word, but whenever you read this in a journal, you know, in somebody's journal article, they just say it converges uniformly. They don't say why. And I just assumed, because I'm lazy, that it was probably easy, but it wasn't. Well, depends what you mean by easy. Okay, let's return to, so that's the end of the recall. That's just a little side comment. So, we now are trying to solve the equation dB dz bar equals g. Unfortunately, g is not a Carlson measure, so we can't use the Peter Jones construction that we didn't do yet. We're close to doing it. So now we have to do what Tom Wolfe did. Oops. Wolfe noticed that remember G has already got derivatives of F in it. Wolfe noticed that if you differentiate G a second time, but with respect to Z, you don't get any extra derivatives. They just stay first derivatives. Why? Because I hope the formula is still up there. Doesn't appear to be. The formula for G was, this just means wiggle, something like this. It had Fi's being multiplied by Fj prime bars and divided by similar types of things, but they were definitely bounded away from zero on the bottom. If you apply a ddz derivative here, you'll notice that when you hit the Fj prime bar, it vanishes. Because this is anti-analytic. You hit ddz, it kills it. So the derivatives never pile up. You don't ever get a second derivative. You only ever get first derivatives, and now you get them squared. So you obviously get this a constant depending on the delta. And once again, the L infinity norm of the vector f, this time times the square. So the nice thing about this, again, is that when you differentiate with respect to z's, you never get second derivatives. They never show up. Whereas if you differentiated dg dz bar, then you would get fj double prime. That's bad. Okay, so what do we now have? We note that G has the following estimates. So this is a bit suggestive to write them down. I mean, it's a bit unmotivated to write them down this way, but there's G of Z, and there's G of Z squared times 1 minus mod Z, and there's G prime times 1 minus mod Z. And I claim that each of these things is dominated by a constant depending on the norm of F times one over mod z inverse. So each of these things, let's go here. Each of these things is equal to or less than some constant, depending on the delta, the L infinity norm of f, divided by 1 minus z. Actually, if I put here z squared, it makes no difference. Remember, 1 minus mod z squared is only 1 minus z times 1 plus z, and 1 plus z is between 1 and 2. So it's just that I'm used to writing it like this. It's the same thing, which implies that all three functions are, well, this doesn't imply that they're integrable because this thing fails to be integrable on the disk, right? It looks like 1 over the distance to the boundary, but it's certainly in weak L1. So all three of these things are in weak L1, I mean, just trivially, by Cauchy's inequalities. What we would like to do, what Tom Wolf noticed, all three of these functions, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's because this one has F primed in it. This one has F primed, yeah, I should have put this down, F prime, maybe I should put equal to or less than with a wiggle, equal to or less than with a wiggle, equal to or less than with a wiggle, F prime Z squared. I didn't tell you where Cauchy's inequalities came from. Applied to F, because, yeah, thank you for pointing that out. I kept saying Cauchy's inequalities. Applied to the bounded function F. That's where you get that thing, the F. And what you get, of course, is divided by the distance to the boundary. That's the trivial part of Cauchy's theorem, or Cauchy's estimates. It simply says that at a point like that, the derivative, the nth derivative, is at most 1 over the nth power of the distance to the boundary, right? So that's just Cauchy's inequalities, which of course are not good enough. So what do we have? These things are all in weak L1. Well, we actually like to show that they we also know that G is not even an L1 for a Blaschka product, right? That was the comment from Rudin, 1955. That F prime need not even be integrable. So in these three functions, the best you can say is that they're all in weak L1. Maybe, in fact, G cannot be improved. And part of Tom Wolf's clever construction. Of course, it involves several things. It's noticing that, this, and the next step altogether. Oh, G is that phi I time. Yeah, it's basically a derivative of F. Is the main term, and other stuff is controlled. Tom. Oh, the Z is at the center, and so there's an inequality that says if you take the nth derivative at Z equal to or less than, I don't remember where the m factorial goes, but r to the m, and on the top you put f L infinity, and there's an m factorial somewhere. Upstairs? Yeah. And this is where B of Z is contained in the disk. You have to be able to put a disk of radius R. So that's the Cauchy's inequalities, which you get from. Okay. So what Tom Wolf then noticed is that these are morally somehow looking the same. However, these two are far better. And so, to show that they are in L1, they're actually Carlson measures. Strong statement. This one is, of course, far from that. And it's very easy to prove. Wolf did that, let's call it d mu 1, is g squared dz. And the other one, let's call it d mu 2, which is g prime z minus z squared dz. Lawson measures, H2 measures. With, of course, the control, and that is the one Carlson norm, H2 Carlson, and the mu2 Carlson norm. Both of these things are less than some universal constant time. The form of the data, which of course is the thing we must always keep track of. Probably a comment I should have made before. No, I should make right now. I didn't have to make. To try and solve this equation, dB dz equals the g, we want things nice, at least continuous up to the back. We don't want nastiness to occur. Because we actually want to, the estimate we want to get will be on the boundary. So what we're going to do is in the, this before, is in the original problem, you have these h infinity. You blow a little bit so that they spill out over the, that's this f sub r thing where r is less than, so they're actually defined a little bit further out. We're going to, so all proof, we're going to imagine that f sub r is in place. Everything, everywhere. So that at least a priori, our function f c infinity on the closed disk. And when we're solving the equation, which we haven't, which we're about, we're going to get one that's at least continuous up to the boundary. However, the solutions will not be functions, because after all, db dz bar is, oh, why don't I put absolute, probably because thinking of positive measures, that a complex measure is a Carlson measure, total variation is a Carlson measure. So that's, it's of course, that's the equation we want to solve. And it's not zero. So B is analytic. It doesn't satisfy maximum principle. So knowing that, that B is on the boundary doesn't imply that B is inside. However, we need to keep track of an estimate for B on the boundary, because if you look at how we see the function G from it, did some other subtraction of things were already okay. F was already okay, already being okay meaning B. And end up with is a that's still bounded on the and even know anything much about the bound of B inside. In the end, the thing we're looking at, right, because we end up getting dg r equals zero by subtracting this off. So in the end, we end up with which we have a good bound on the boundary. Now know it's analytic, therefore the maximum says we have the good bound inside. That's because we can't get bounded inside, only on the boundary. Which means we want nice functions. Do that. Okay, and the bounds that we're going to get from the Peter Jones one, we have bounds on the boundary that depend on, okay, the on the R that you expand by. Be a function of the original L infinities of the Fs. And the original L infinities of the Fs, the reason why we're fussing with this all the way up, we want our solutions to these blown up problems satisfy uniform estimates, and we do the this argument. That's that bounded thing. A R0 Ascoli subsequence that converges, etc., etc., and it will converge to a solution to the corona problem. So we solve with these lifted FRs, but it's important to get uniform estimates. The thing that's important is we don't have to worry about estimates on the bound. That our functions are nice enough, that the data are connected to the boundary. Continuity is good enough. So that's why. And of course, estimates are important because the bound, the L infinity bound of boundary, which we will prove, we're going to use Peter Jones' solution, we're going to use this method, we're going to get that B boundary It's dominated by these Carlson measures, but they in turn are dominated by the L infinity norm of F. This is an important estimate. And in fact, because G prime both have, they're both dominated by F prime squared, right? Just differences of the F part. What to do is show that F prime squared thing, the measure, whenever F is an function, you can probably guess. The first day I gave two definitions of H2. One of the definitions was, you know, on circles and taking the other definition was for the whole disk, equivalent norm for H2, and that's essentially what so just run through the argument, it's pretty clear. See this? Prove the following, and F prime Z squared Z. That Poisson measure norm of this thing to a less than a constant H infinity norm. Because once this particular thing is a constant, then it's true for every component, and then that Carlson measure dominates. I mean, they're based on the same thing in weighting. So it suffices that for this. From two factors, two norm of F squared comparable to the integral disk of that thing, 1 minus, that's the calculation we did today, just using expansion or orthogonality potential. Thing we need that we did weeks ago, characterization of the multipliers of H infinity. So we know those two things to get these expressions for the colors. This and the fact that, oh, that's not the form of psi as a pointwise multiplier H2 be equal to H2. So these two spaces and their norms coincide. Also, that was the thing. Remember, I mentioned that the adjoint of the station operator is reproducing kernels as for H2, a magical formula, and that. So those are the two things. And the way we get this is, well, you just start testing it. So for H, we have, what you do is you want to look at H squared. Let's call this measure a name. Where to the top? Mu is that measure with time in it. Then d mu over